Track 12. And this week's feature item is one of our occasional interviews. This one lasts for about 20 minutes. Here it is. Today I'm talking to local author Stephanie Austin, who writes delightful crime novels set in and around Ashburton. I came across Stephanie's books pretty much as soon as the first one became available in 2019, and I and my wife have been reading her subsequent books as they've emerged. Stephanie, thank you for your time today. I've really been looking forward to meeting you and chatting about your work. But can we start before the writing began? Mm-hmm. At the back of your first book, we're told that you've enjoyed a varied career as an artist, an astrologer, a trader in antiques and crafts, and that was before going into teaching and working for the Devon Schools Library Service. So, can we start with the astrology? What was all that about?
Well, you can. Actually, the teaching came first. And I decided that I didn't want to be a teacher. So I abandoned my teaching career and set out to work as an artist and also to dabble in writing, hoping to get published even way back then. The astrology really came around because life was in the dustbin pretty much. And I'd always been sort of interested in it in the way that everybody is. You know, we read your horoscopes in the magazine and some of them seem to be have some bearing on your life and a lot of them don't. But it was really more the descriptions of personality, the signs that I was interested in. And I used to think, yes, okay, that's reasonably accurate, but that's not quite the way I am. So some local classes became available. So I started studying it and started casting and interpreting charts. And this is what I used to do and used to do for other people once I got a bit practiced at it. And at one time, and I have found it very, very useful at times to have the astrological perspective on what's going on. But I don't do it very much these days. Right. I mean, since I took up writing, I don't do much of anything I used to do because it takes up most of my time. But yes, I mean, at one particular time in my life, it was very important to me. Right. Yeah.
When you wouldn't use it for things like predicting the outcome of a race or something.
You can do, but I'm not really very interested in prediction. I'm more interested in what the natal chart, and you can only cast a chart if you know someone's birth date and the place they were born and the time they were born. What that actually reveals about personality, I think, and relationships and so on, I think is absolutely fascinating. And that was the area that I was really interested
right.
in, rather than prediction.
I confess I'm a sceptic.
Well, yes, and I can quite understand anyone being a sceptic if their experience of astrology is simply what, you know, comes through the magazines. And on television and radio, I mean, I have just been amazed at what people get away with saying, which, you know, is clearly not based on much knowledge or...
No. My experience. Grandfather got interested in numerology at one time, and I found all sorts of bits of paper. Correspondence, very weird, very
yes,
weird.
Yes, yeah.
Let's move on, shall we? You mentioned already being an artist. Mm. Was that as a painter? And what sort of style?
Well, no style at all, really. I used to do pet portraits and things, and then I moved into silk painting ultimately, and I don't do that anymore. But, yes, at that particular time, I had a small stall in an antiques market in Bristol. And I used to paint and put my paintings on the stall as well. And that's how I met a proper artist. And he had a stall at Bermondsey Antiques Market. And that's really, I think, where my inspiration for Dead in Devon, the first of my books, came from.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I was about to ask you, I mean, how did your interest in antiques come about? Because that features very heavily in your books.
Well, really because of this friend of mine who was an artist, and he was a brilliant artist. He could paint in almost any style at all. And he had this stall in Bermondsey Market, which used to happen on a Friday. And on a Thursday evening, Bermondsey Square in London was more or less closed down to traffic. And you had to take your place by your stall on your particular bit of the curb at night on the Thursday, or you couldn't get near it next day. And so you would spend the night very uncomfortably on, you know, in your vehicle at the side of the road. And at 4 a.m, the gentleman from the council would come and deliver all the trestle tables and the ironmongery so you could put your stall together. And it was cold and it was dark. But the interesting thing from my point of view, and there were hundreds of stall holders there at that time, and some of them used to make their own antiques. And I used to find this quite fascinating. And my friend, I discovered that the owners of galleries and antique shops and so on would approach him and say, "Can you do me half a dozen Victorian farmyard scenes for next week, Tom?" And he would. And he had a method for making them look pictures look old. And that's in Dead in Devon, as it was. So he'd be kind of... So that sort of, I suppose, gave me the inspiration for what I might write about. Because having always been, you know, an avid reader and having always wanted to write and having not had any success really earlier in my life, I kind of put it away. And it wasn't until I retired in 2016 that I started to think about writing again. And I took that old story
Okay. Well, as I mentioned before we started recording, my mother was born in Bermondsey.
Oh, right.
Early 20th century. Mm. And she may well have known Bermondsey Market.
She may well have known, yeah, she might. But I mean, it's been trading for several... Yeah. It used to trade way back in the 18th century and it traded all night. And the reason it traded at night is because you don't have to prove provenance between the hours of sundown and sunup.
Really?
So you could sell stolen goods all night long and no one's going to take a blind bit of notice. It's different now, of course, obviously. Yeah. But yes, that was the law at the time.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, before we get on to your writing and your books, can we talk about libraries and library services? Do libraries, and indeed books, hard copy books, have a future in the digital age?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think when digital books started coming out in digital form, everyone assumed that the paper book was dead, the hard copy book was dead. And it's not true at all. Some people prefer to read on something like an e-book or a Kindle, and they are very, very useful tools if you're going away somewhere and you want, you know, saves you taking a great stack of books with you. But the majority of people still seem to love reading books, and not just the content, but the feel of the book, the smell of the book, even. It seems to be something that people really enjoy, that experience. And I don't think that the hard copy book is dead at all. No, I don't.
So why is it that local libraries are struggling so much? I mean, Ashburton is a case in point.
I think because a lot of local funding has been withdrawn. I mean, libraries used to be run by councils, and now a lot of them, particularly in this area, are run by volunteers. And so, obviously, you know, financially, that's very challenging. And also, COVID has had its effect on libraries, like everything else. You know, people are reluctant to come out and mix with other people and so on. But I think they seem to be holding their own very well. I mean, certainly because the British Library every year publishes for authors a list of their borrowings and so on. If you register your books with the British Library, you do get a small sum of money when somebody takes a book out. And judging by that, I would say that, you know, borrowings are very healthy. Certainly, I was informed by a friend who tried to borrow my last book from the library that there was a 30-week wait.
Good Lord.
Which was great fun. But actually, it seems that a lot of people were waiting for it. So, I mean, if you multiply that out sort of generally, then, you know, I would say libraries are continuing to hold their own.
You must have been very chuffed by
that. I was very chuffed, yes. And, of course, the volunteers at libraries work tremendously hard in creating events and that kind of thing to draw people into libraries. I mean, you know, there are always author talks going on or some kind of event for children or something. You know, they never seem to stop in terms of actually looking for opportunities to involve people.
We have to be so grateful to people who volunteer.
Oh, we do, don't
Dara's
we?
Dara's Journal wouldn't exist without volunteers.
Absolutely.
Libraries would struggle without volunteers. Even the museum where we are today.
Absolutely.
It depends on volunteers to keep it going.
Yes, and in Ashburton we have a volunteer-led repair cafe who is dedicated to keeping things out of landfill. And,
I've used it.
Oh, you've used it, have you? Oh, right. Did they successfully repair what you wanted?
They did. Our toaster was having electrical problems.
Oh, wow.
They repaired it.
Right, that could have been my husband repaired that. You don't know.
No, I know the chap who did it. Right. It wasn't him. So, let's come on to the writing. What inspired you to start? You've been churning out books pretty regularly since the first one came out. And that's not a critical
No, churning out is about right.
But why did it take you so long to produce one in the first place?
I think because having spent quite a lot of time, when I was in that period when I was trying to earn a living as an artist, an antiques person and so on, I was also writing. And although I used to get some encouragement from publishers, you know, my rejection slips were quite, you know, they weren't that unkind, they were quite kind. Basically, I just didn't get that golden ticket. So I decided, well, I've spent enough of my life trying to scribble away here. I'm going to go off and do something different. So I sort of put it on the back burner for a long time. But it always niggled. I mean, it always was still something I wanted to do. So when we retired, I thought, I'm going to dig out that book I wrote back in 1980, whatever it was, when I was doing the antiques market. And if I think it's any good, I'll have another go. So that literally is what happened. And this time, I was fortunate in securing an agent who made me do a lot of rewriting before she was prepared to take me on. But, you know, and we were very lucky in selling the book quite quickly. So that, you know, that's what started it all, really.
Did you find the rewriting process agonising or difficult?
It was a question, really, of kind of slimming it and trimming it to fit a particular genre, because this is what you must do these days. I mean, you know, books are sold not just according to their whether they're crime novels, but what kind of crime novel are they? And so you're kind of getting rid of anything extraneous. And like a lot of sort of first-time writers, I put everything but the kitchen sink into this book. So some of that had to come out. So it wasn't too painful a process, but it took a while.
Yeah. Your first book was Dead in Devon.
Yeah.
Very much based on a very recognisable Ashburton. Why Ashburton?
Well, that's a very good question, and I have to tell the truth here and say that originally it wasn't Ashburton, because originally I did, again, what a lot of authors do, I wanted to create my own little Dartmoor town. And so it had bits of Ashburton, bits of Chagford, bits of, you know, Bovey and so on. And I gave it a fictional name. And when my agent came to sell the book to my publishers, they said, well, we really like the story, but we want this somewhere real. So, and I didn't have long to make up my mind where it was going to be. And as Ashburton was the place I felt I knew best, then Ashburton it became. And it's a wonderful choice, actually. It's absolutely the right choice, I think.
Why?
It's a place of great atmosphere. It's got a tremendous history. It's full of lovely, hidden little places, nooks and crannies, which are very useful for discovering dead bodies and hiding them and so on. The location is perfect. It's right on the edge of the moor. So you've got all that glorious landscape just within reach. At the same time, you know, you're just a slip road away from the A38. So, you know, if you need to police whizzing around the place, they can get places fairly easily. Yeah. So the whole place is just right as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yeah. I find it slightly frustrating because I know Ashburton reasonably well, and the places like Taylor's and Churches and North Street are mentioned. And then you come to places like Shadow Lane and Sun Lane, and I think, I can't find them. Where are they?
No, those are fictional. I mean, there is a blend between what's real and what's fictional. You know, you can have a street that is real and then you turn off into somewhere fictional. Mm. And it's important to keep it that way, really, because whereas it's nice for pubs and cafes and things like that to be recognisable, you don't want somebody knocking on your door saying, is this where Juno Brown lives? You know, so you've got to kind of keep some mystery in it, some fiction in it. But I regularly meet people who've been driving themselves crazy trying to find out where Shadow Bay is.
Do you have a personal map of where all these
I have a map in my head, yeah, absolutely. And it involves elasticating what's real in order to fit in a bit that's not real.
You've just mentioned Juno Brown, who is your lead character.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about Juno Brown and who she is? And
I don't know who she is. I suppose she's part of me. Not that I am remotely like her. I mean, she's brave, for a start, and I am not. I wanted to create someone who is physically different from me, which is why I made her very tall and the red hair and so on. I think she just comes from that period in my life when I was coping on my own. You know, I didn't have much money, I didn't have much of a career, and I was doing several different jobs to juggle at once. I think, particularly in today's gig economy, that's something that young people can relate to quite a lot. But I suppose she sort of grew out of there. She sort of lives in the keyboard and comes, you know, or she wakes me up at 4 in the morning to say, well, this is a good idea, you know, why don't we do this?
You take her into some difficult physical situations and also emotional situations. Do you get invested in the character?
Oh, yeah, I think, yes, absolutely. I am defined by my publisher as cosy crime, which is something that always surprises me. I can understand why, I guess, because there's not a lot of blood and gore, and, you know, I don't deal with crimes of sexual predation or anything like that. So I can understand why I am considered to be up at the cosy end of the market. But I'm a great believer in the fact that because a book is defined as a cosy crime, that's no excuse for there not being any danger or excitement or jeopardy in the book. So I try to make mine a kind of blend of... I'm on the edge, I'm edgy. Yeah. I'm cosy crime, but I'm edgy with it, yes.
Yeah. Well, for those people who are not familiar with the books, perhaps we ought to say that Juno really struggles to get through to the end of the first book, doesn't she?
She does. I mean, it's the murder of one of her clients, because she works as a domestic goddess, you know, looking after people, basically, that leads her into investigation, and then she discovers she's quite good at it, actually.
Yes, indeed. Can I just read the opening
paragraph, or
a few sentences, just to give people a flavour? It starts as a prologue. Murder is a messy business, especially for the person who has to clear up afterwards. In this case, me. I didn't commit the murder, you understand. I just found it. Him. I found him. Poor old Nick lying on the hearthrug, his skull smashed in.
Yeah.
That's a very arresting opening.
Well, it is. And that sentence about his skull smashed in and what should have been inside it being on the fireplace, that's probably the most gory sentence I've ever written. And I have to tell people, don't be put off by that, because, you know, I don't write a lot of gory detail generally. But yes, and that came about really because I have a friend who's an ex-detective, and I don't know why I asked him this question, but years ago I had asked him the question, what happens after a murder? Who clears up the murder scene? And he said, well, I assumed in my innocence that there was maybe some police department that did it. And he said, well, no. Once the forensics have got what they want from the murder scene, it's left to the relatives or it's left to the friends. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, this is a pretty awful prospect.
Grim
prospect. And what's it like to be the person doing that? And that really was part of the motivation for that prologue.
Okay, yeah. Interesting. Can you share your writing methods with us? Are you one of these people who sort of writes for 4 hours at the beginning of the day and then stops?
Depending on where we are with our deadline. I mean, I have just finished writing a book. I've just finished number 8. It doesn't even have a title yet, but it's done. I now have a year to do number 9. So at the moment, no, I'm not doing much except just thinking about it, about things and where I'm going to do and what I'm going to do and where the story might go. And I still tend to kind of ease myself in fairly gradually. But when we're getting near deadline, then obviously it's, you know, 4 hours in the morning, a couple more hours in the afternoon, so on. And I certainly do wake up early in the mornings with ideas. Whether I actually get out of bed right at that time of day depends on what else I might have to do, whether I need to be awake later on. I do try and fit writing around my life and have a life as well. You know, I mean, it started off, I thought it was going to be a hobby. It now takes up most of my time.
Sure.
But I am retired and I don't earn a living from it. You know, there's not that much money in it. So I try to have a life as well. I don't spend all my time up in my bunker. You know.
I was going to ask, do you have a study or a shed?
Like a lot of writers, I just have the spare bedroom, you know, so that's where I shut myself away.
You've written 7 or 8 books now. Mm. The early ones were very much based on the antiques trade.
Mm.
The later ones use more diverse themes, this dog napping and farm
machinery.
Well,
yes.
Are you running out of plots?
No, not at all, unfortunately, no, because there's so much crime around. It's interesting, when you start, you think, you know, I might do a book about, say, the dog napping came about because of COVID, really, because there was so much going on. And there were so many terrible scams going on as well, with when people had advertised the fact they'd lost their dog and people were ringing them up and saying, I've got it, and so on, and they hadn't, and getting money out of them. I felt it was something that was worth writing about.
Mm.
But like a lot of things, once you start to actually research these things, you discover they're much, much bigger subjects than perhaps you anticipate. With my second book, Dead on Dartmoor, I wanted to write about fly tipping, which sounds like an odd thing, but it is a real problem in the countryside. And so I started to read about it and realised this is big crime. This is organised crime. You know, stashing hazardous waste more cheaply than you would have to do it if you were doing it properly is a real business. And so that developed into a major part of the plot, whereas originally it was just going to be a sort of, you know, side issue that I was going to deal with, but it developed into something sort of fairly major, and that can happen once you start to really look at things.
I suppose all writers get asked this, but do you base your characters on real people? I'm sure I can recognise at least 2 of your characters in the first book.
Really? Yeah. Yeah, they do. They ask a lot. To be honest, none of those people in my books are based on people in Ashburton. And most of them are not based on real people at all. although there might be characteristics of certain people that creep in. You know. Most readers think they can recognise two regular characters called Ricky and Morris,
yeah,
because they're a gay couple and they run a theatrical hire company. And I was very surprised when I started really to spend a lot of time in Ashburton that there was such a couple living in the centre of the town. However, the inspiration for Ricky and Morris goes back a long, long way. Back in the 1970s, I was working at the Bristol Hippodrome, because I'm a Bristol girl, was working backstage on a pantomime. And the two gentlemen who played the ugly sisters in Cinderella made all their own costumes, and they were a very outrageous couple. I think that Ricky and Morris were born then, you know, and I've sort of been dragged up into my consciousness later.
But that's interesting. Well, they are the couple I thought I
recognised. Ah, right, right, okay. And sometimes people ask me, you know, if I've got a particularly grumpy antiques shop owner or something, they say, that's so-and-so, isn't it? And it isn't, and I'm sort of horrified, you know. I don't want people to think that way.
But, yeah. Okay. Do you have to do much marketing yourself, or is that down to the publishers and the
agents? No, I do a lot. I mean, my publishers are very good getting my books into bookshops, but I do a lot of promotion going around talking to booksellers in some of the smaller independent shops. I do a lot of talking for groups like U3A and Probus and WI and so on, and book clubs. Because the more you spread the word yourself, I think the better it is. And you need to do this. No one is going to do that part of it for you.
I would love to see Juno Brown, and that's Brown with an E.
Absolutely.
Translated to the television screen. Is there any prospect of that?
There has been a prospect. You know, there have been kind of overtures, but nothing that's ever actually materialised as yet.
Can I just move away, but we come to draw this to a close? Obviously, you're interested in books. I'm sure you read a lot. Has a book ever made you cry?
Oh, gosh, yes. I can remember I was reading Mervyn Peake's trilogy, Gormenghast, and when he killed off the character of Fuchsia, I cried. I could not pick the book up for days and days. I just couldn't bear the thought of it.
Is Gormenghast your favourite?
No, book? No. I mean, I did go through a period when I was very much into fantasy, but that's not true anymore. I'd really rather read about real people.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Stephanie.
I appreciate it.
The most important question of all, are your books available in audio format?
They are. They are available through Audibles. So if you subscribe to Audibles, then you can hear them being read.
I'll look up the details of that and pass them on for people who may not have done so. But as I say, thank you so much for your time. Is there anything I should have asked you that I haven't?
Well, you could ask me when my next book's coming out.
Let's do that.
But I don't know. The current book, the one that was published in hardback back in November, A Devon Midwinter Murder, is coming out in paperback next month.
All right.
So that will make it available to a lot more people.
Yeah. Okay.
But as for number eight, the just finished number eight, later this year, but I don't know when.
Hope it all goes well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Towards the end of the interview, Stephanie mentioned that her books were available in audio format from Audible Books. This is an Amazon company which provides a subscription-based service. Unfortunately, I don't think that Stephanie's books are available through the RNIB library or Calibre. Anyway, I do hope you enjoyed our little chat.